Good evening, good evening. I hope you can all hear me. Just a few of you still coming in at the back. If you just find a seat and sit down, that would be great. Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. My name is Henrietta Moore. I'm the Deputy Director of the LSE. Welcome to the LSE and to the third Dixon's public lecture. Dixon's PLC president, Sir Stanley Carms, established the Dixon's chair in new media and the internet in 2001. And Professor Robin Mansell holds this chair, and we'll hear a few words from Robin at the end of Ian Pearson's talk tonight. The LSE is very grateful to Dixon's for their continuing support and for the energy and commitment they have given us and allowed us to give to you in this important area of new work. Now, the third Dixon's lecture is a particularly important event for us here at the LSE, not just, of course, because we welcome Ian Pearson, who is a wonderful speaker, about whom I shall speak at a little more length in a second, but this lecture is important to us because this year marks the launch at the school of a new department of media and communications, which Robin Mansell, as the Dixon's chair, is convening. Now, this new department has a strong interdisciplinary approach. Its teaching and research focus on the media and global networks and their significance for democracy, globalization, literacy, ethics, and policy. And with its focus on both older media and newer media and on communications technologies, it's building bridges not only across the social sciences and within the LSE, but also towards related fields in science and technology. And we are signalling our desire here at the LSE to build these new kinds of bridges through our invitation to Ian Pearson tonight to present the Dixon's lecture. Now, Ian Pearson graduated in 1981 in applied mathematics and theoretical physics from Queen's University Belfast. And after several years designing missile systems, which I must say, Ian, sounds absolutely amazing, designing missile systems, he joined BT Laboratories in 1985, analysing computer and broadband network technologies. He's worked in cybernetics, networks, and mobile systems groups. Now, Ian currently works as BT Exact's futurologist, a position he's held for more than 13 years. BT Exact works on the internet, intelligent agents, and web technologies. And BT Exact is BT's research, technology, and IT operations business, helping customers to gain maximum advantage from communications technology. Ian's own work concentrates on mapping the progress of new information technology developments, considering both the technological and social implications of smart environments, pervasive computing, symbiotic networks, and also looking at how artificial intelligence may influence our lives in the future, both positively and negatively. He lectures extensively and has been the recipient of many prizes and awards for his papers. He's on the editorial board of the journal Foresight, is a fellow of the Royal Society of Arts, a member of the Association of Professional Futurists and of the World Futures Society. His topic tonight is business and society beyond 2015, and how will new technologies dramatically change business and society in the coming decades? Please welcome Ian Pearson.
Good evening, everyone. Thank you for coming. I know you had a choice of what to do this evening. As you've just heard, my job is as a futurologist. You're thinking, well, what a stupid job title. Well, I couldn't think of a better one. What I do is I study the future. And you can study the future in areas like information technology because the technology progresses in very, very well-defined ways. We already know, for example, pretty much exactly what the chips will look like coming out of the Intel fabrication plants in about 10 years' time. We know what the feature size is, you know exactly what the structures will be, because they've already been designed, and the chip fabrication plants are already being commissioned and being planning permissioned and stuff, so they're going to be built very, very soon. So that makes it very, very predictable. And the other thing is that we try to invent things, and then we talk to consumer electronics companies and persuade them how wonderful an idea it is and try to make them build it, So you can actually invent the future, and it becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy. And we use all of those tricks to try and make the predictions as accurate as possible. And the stuff we were talking about 10 years ago, 85% of that has happened. And I'm very, very pleased with that. But it's only possible because we work in an area of information technology which is immensely predictable. So if anyone else tries to sell you views of the future in other areas like fashion and stuff, you know, run a mile if it's any more than 6 months ahead, because a lot of things simply cannot be predicted any more than a few months ahead. This is where I work. It's a little field outside of Ipswich called Martlesham Heath. It used to be an airfield 30 or 40 years ago during the Second World War. It's where Douglas Bader used to fly from. Now we've got 4,500 engineers working there on different aspects of telecoms. Not one of those designs telephones. So if you think that future telecoms is about designing different telephones with new features on and stuff, none of that is what we do as our day-to-day living. And I'm going to share with you for about 3/4 of an hour the sort of stuff which we actually do in order to stay in business once we're giving you phone calls for free in about 10 years' time. And I noticed recently that you get a whole hour for 6p, and I'm thinking, you know, my shares are going to tumble through the floor if we carry on doing things like that. But ultimately, we expect fully that you will not pay at all for telecoms in 10, 15 years' time. There are so many different ways of getting telecoms for free that you're not going to bother paying anybody for it, so you don't actually need a telecoms industry. So I'm going to tell you about all of the different technologies coming along that we're hoping to latch onto in order to stay in a job, basically. Yes, I'm here. The first thing that we can observe is that convergence, which is pretty much complete within information technology. We had computing and we had telecoms, and there was IBM and there was BT and lots of other big companies fighting against each other. And they were in very, very different areas. And now we're all in the same field. We sell software, IBM sell telecoms, Sony sell telecoms, Sony even sell broadband networks. And you think, well, we got complete convergence of all of these things, and you know, being the Dixon's lecture, you can buy stuff in Dixon's now which combines all of the different aspects of IT in single devices. You can get smartphones or PDAs which are linked to the network or wireless LANs. So all of these things have come together. But that's nearly finished now. In the next year or so, you're going to see, you know, all of the devices you can buy will have all of this stuff in them automatically. And what you're going to see next is a convergence with biotechnology and nanotechnology and cognitive technologies. It's basically, how does your brain work? And we're trying desperately hard to get computers which are conscious, which we can stick inside your skin and inside sweets and stuff. And I'm going to tell you about all of those things over the next little while. But it isn't going to be difficult to use. If it's difficult to use, you won't buy it and you won't use it. So one of the big impacts over the next few years is rapid developments of things like interactive TV and home robotics and stuff. And you know, we talked some years ago to Sony about the possibility of making home robots with telecoms links in them. And now you can go out and buy for £1,000, probably even in Dixon's, you can buy an Ebo with, it looks like a little lion cub or a cat or a dog, whichever one you want, and it's got 500-word voice recognition. And it'll take pictures if you tell it to take pictures. And it'll deal with your email, and it'll read the email out to you across a voice link, and it'll act as a security robot around your home. And that's today. Now, the last time I tried to demonstrate one of these, I took it out of the bag and switched it on in front of a classroom full of kids, and they thought it was fantastic. It booted up and went through all of its boot-up sequence, and then it keeled over and died. So there's a mechanical reliability problem in there, but the IT is certainly getting there, and very, very soon indeed, your real cat and your real dog will be obsolete, and you can kick them out and tell them to go and fend for themselves and catch some birds or something, because you're not going to look after them anymore, because the electronic dog and cat will be very, very much better. Your real cat can't do your shopping in Tesco's. Sony's Ebo can. But this brings us to a field where the technology is actually becoming invisible. And one of the really hot projects that we're working on, and we know all of our competitors are working on as well, it isn't just BT, it's called pervasive computing. And what this really means is that the computing is going to be everywhere around you. You think, well, what does that mean? It means that the little tags that you've got, I'll try and find one, inside your suit, instead of being just a simple tag, you know, they will actually have a radio frequency identity tag using electronics imprinted on that, so that when I give this to the dry cleaners, it'll tell them exactly, you know, what regime this needs to be treated by. And if I'm stupid enough to shove it in my own washing machine, it'll reject it and say, you've got to take this to a dry cleaner, stupid, and all of that sort of stuff. But it really gets quite exciting because these tags will be everywhere. And you take something like the London environment. We're looking at things like smart chewing gum. when you chew chewing gum, you know, it tastes quite nice, and then eventually you probably spit it out on the street if you're not very sophisticated. And what actually happens there is when you're chewing it, you're investing an awful lot of mechanical energy. Now, MIT came to us a couple of years ago with this invention of a smart tooth implant, where you could take one of your own teeth and, you know, gets taken out. By the time you get my age, you're bound to have lost one tooth or so. And instead of paying a few thousand pounds for just a piece of ceramic to go in its place, you can now go out and buy a smart tooth implant with an MP3 player and a radio device implanted in it. And when you chew, you're charging up the capacitors, and it will actually work once you've got rid of it, once you need to use it. So why not do that with chewing gum? And we actually developed a way of charging up chewing gum so that when the 16-year-old spits it out on the street and every single paving stone in Britain is covered with two or three pieces of chewing gum, those pieces of chewing gum can actually act as cell phone nodes, which will work over a few metres radius for about 20 minutes after you've discarded that piece of chewing gum. And every time somebody steps on it, it charges it up for another few minutes worth of operation as well. And then we did the calculations for cigarettes, and we worked out that for about 1.5 to 2 pence, you can add a little device into a cigarette called a thermocouple and a little chip in the filter, which will allow it to act as a cell phone node. And if you harvest just 1% of the energy from that cigarette when you're smoking it, and then you chuck the cigarette on the street, again, it'll work for about half an hour or so after you've thrown it away. So, you know, given that the refuse disposal people aren't that fast that they get rid of the stuff off the street within an hour or two, this is actually a very good way of getting a trans-European telephone network. And we thought, you know, oh God, we're in this industry, we're trying to sell people phone calls. Why is anybody going to buy a telephone call off BT or Orange or Vodafone or whatever when they can get them completely for free from, you know, pieces of chewing gum and cigarette stubs? And then we talked to some other companies who make sweets, and we thought, you know, this is getting worse and worse, because actually it's possible to make jelly babies, and you can get a jelly baby and you can put little RFID tags in it, which would cost less than a penny. And when you eat a jelly baby normally, it doesn't do very much. But in 10 years' time, when you eat a jelly baby and you bite its head off, it'll have a little tag in there which detects that it's now separated from the rest of the body. So it'll send a distress call to the rest of the jelly babies back in the packet. And they will use something called symbiotic network technology, where they set up a little network between each other, and they use their combined artificial intelligence to set up a denial of service attack on your corporate LAN, and they trash your home hard drive and stuff like that. And basically, we're looking towards a world where the jelly babies fight back. And that's quite terrifying. And today you pay 50p for a packet of jelly babies, but in 2010 you probably pay several pounds, because it's really good fun, because if you eat them in the wrong order, you know, your life's complete misery. So it's now exciting eating these jelly babies as well. And adding these things to our everyday environment really makes everything very, very sophisticated. And you can add as much technology as you can imagine into the humblest of things around you. There's even a beer glass. You know, this isn't a beer glass, but you can imagine it's got Guinness in it, and it's the right shape. And already you can get Guinness glasses in some pubs in Dublin, where when you've got down to the last inch, it will automatically call for a waitress or a waiter who will bring you a new glass of beer, because it's got a pressure sensor built into the glass, and it's got a network linked to the wireless LAN in the pub. And that's in a beer glass. So this technology is going to be absolutely everywhere. Nothing at all that you can look at will have technology not in it. And you're thinking, well, what about my body? Well, here's stuff which we're working on today in BT. This is called active skin. And it occurred to us that Moore's Law is going to continue for another decade or two, and chips are going to get smaller and smaller and smaller over the next few years, and that will continue until you get chips which are so small you can't even see them. And so I looked up Encyclopedia Britannica, and I looked up the size of a skin cell, and says a skin cell is typically 10 microns across. I thought, 10 microns? You know, we're talking about 0.01 micron technology for semiconductor devices. So 10 microns is about 500 or 600 of these devices across. And that's in this direction, and another 500 or 600 lines of that in that direction, and 500 or 600 columns in this direction. So you're talking tens of thousands of transistors in the volume of a skin cell in about 5 or 6 years' time. Now that figure is actually quite important, because when I started work way back in 1981, and my bosses gave me an Apple II computer, which cost about 2,000 quid at the time, it was very sophisticated state-of-the-art stuff, and I had to write missile simulations and design weapons and stuff on it. I still do weapons as a hobby these days. I don't like to design weapons of mass destruction now and again, because that's the sort of guy I am. But today, you can get a device called a Pentium 4, which has got 50 million transistors. And that Apple II had 9,000 transistors. Now, when you do all of those sums, you work out that given the increasing clock rates and the number of transistors you've got now, on paper, my desktop computer should be a million times faster than my first computer back in 1981. And actually, it runs slower on some things, and it's marginally faster on some other things. And we realized we'd gone down the wrong way with all of this. And we thought we can actually design computing in new ways using ultra-simple computing techniques, which allow us to use tiny little gadgets by the million, rather than, you know, single Pentium 4 devices, and we can transform the whole way we use telecoms and computing. So we called it Active Skin, and we realized that, you know, there's no point in carrying a laptop with you in your briefcase if what we can actually do in a few years' time is print the PC into your hand. And that's exactly the sort of stuff we're talking about. We're talking video tattoos. Some of your friends are going out and getting real tattoos, and it takes them a lot of pain on a Friday night after they've had too much beer and stuff, and it's going to last them the rest of their life unless they get some advanced laser treatment to get rid of the tattoos. And you can sneer down your nose at them in a couple of years' time, because you can go out and get a video version of the same thing, which every time you change your girlfriend or boyfriend, the name changes. And in fact, you can actually display television or, you know, real-time video pictures, or use it as a computer interface or a cell phone interface as well, because it's a complete video screen which you can print on your hand. And we worked out exactly how to do that, and we're talking to the manufacturers of this sort of equipment, and we're trying to persuade some of them to go down that road. And it's impossible for any engineer in telecoms to come up with a system which uses one single layer. We're all, you know, programmed from birth to think about multi-layered systems, because all telecom systems use multiple layers. So this has got a five-layer system. It's got an elastoplast-type layer, which is quite thick, and you can definitely see it. And it's got things like cell phones and computers built into it. You just stick it on your skin, and it works. And then you've got a very, very thin layer, which is a thin polymer membrane. And it's the kind of stuff that children use when they're using temporary tattoos that they want to wash off after a few days. And they stick it on the hand, and they put a damp cloth on top of it, and then they peel the paper off a few seconds later. And the thin polymer membrane stays on their skin, and it gradually washes off after a few days. And we can actually print electronics on that, and you can do displays on that, and you can do cell phone links and stuff in the future as well. But then we realized something else, which is that inkjet printers are progressing very, very fast indeed. The ones you buy in Dixon's today will print quite happily on paper, but their big brothers back in the R&D labs, they can actually print directly onto your skin in principle. And certainly in about a year or two, you can walk into a corner shop and buy a cell phone, just stick your hand in a gadget, and it will actually print the cell phone straight onto your skin. There's nothing in physics or chemistry or biology that stops you from doing that. And then we thought about, well, why not get this right into your skin? Why not get it in contact with the blood capillaries and the nervous system? Why not take sensors from your nervous system and record those, and then you can replay them at some future date? And, you know, let's think about sending an orgasm by email, basically. And we thought about that, and we realized that these things are actually achievable in the not very distant future. So we went ahead and we came up with 250 different ideas for what you can do with all of this stuff. We came up with, you know, loads of ideas in no time at all, and you could probably think of loads of ideas that we haven't thought of. And, you know, a 10 micron sphere, which is the same size as a skin cell, in a few years' time, it's actually a very, very large capsule which you can get a lot of electronics into. So we've been designing systems based on this and using communications links between these skin capsules. You can build up almost any electronic circuit that you can think of within the surface of your skin. And as for the nerve connections, well, you know, I'm part of the NBIC Convergence Group sponsored by the EU. It's Nanotech, Biotech, Infotech, Cognition. And already we're looking at things like direct nervous system links for maybe 10 to 15 years from now as real technology. This is not science fiction. This is stuff which you will be able to do in 15 years. You will be able to record the nerve sensations associated with a handshake or making love to your boyfriend or girlfriend. And you can record all of that stuff and replay any experience that you experience anytime you like. Just the same way as looking through your holiday snaps, you can replay an evening that you spent with somebody you really like being with. But this takes us into an area which is already developing in virtual environments. We already have computer games. You're all familiar with the concepts of virtual reality and so on. And you can take that virtual reality and say, well, it isn't just going to be video and audio, which it is today. Already you can take 3D images of the people that you want to associate with, and they're called avatars, and you can populate any virtual environment you care to imagine with these people. You know, we've done it with conference tables, we've done it with Caribbean beaches, we've done it with coffee bars set in the middle of the Sahara Desert. And really, you know, some of the people that you meet in there are real people, some of them are computer programmers dressed up as people, and because of the artificial intelligence level that you have in 10, 15 years' time, you really will not know the difference. And these worlds will be completely virtual. Think of the Star Trek holodeck. You conjure up some fantasy that you want to live out. You explain it in everyday language to the computer. You don't need any C++ programming skills. You just tell the computer what it is you want, and it synthesizes it for you in full 3D, and I'll show you the interfaces for that. And by about 20 years from now, we think that the boundaries between reality and virtual reality will be so subtle that you really will not know half the time whether you're in there. And you've all seen The Matrix, and maybe you've been to see Matrix 3, I haven't personally, but having seen Matrix 1, I'm not that interested in going. You know, that really misses the point. But the virtual environments will be completely and totally convincing. You will not be able to tell the difference between reality and virtual reality once it gets to the point of, you know, 16-bit reproduction of the sensory sensations. But some of the gadgets are much more low-tech, but I've been using this slide for several years. But I like it so much I just couldn't resist putting it in, even though you can already buy this. And in some London nightclubs and some nightclubs over in Japan and so on, you can already pick up a badge at the door where you can program different aspects of your personality. And you can program what sort of car you drive and what your income is, all the important information that people care about. And then you can program your big long list of sexual preferences, and in my case, a tiny list of sexual competences. And you can put all of that on the badge. And instead of spending all of the evening dancing with all the wrong people, you can find somebody with a 95% personality match in the first 5 seconds. So we think, hooray, you know, I'm an IT guru, proves by definition I've got no social skills. I can't wait for this sort of stuff. But now that it exists, I'm married, my wife won't let me use it. And that's sods of it. But take that badge and link it to the network, and you could use it as a network computer. But you have to have a visual interface in order to give you that computing stuff. You've got to superimpose this virtual environment somehow on the real world. Today, you can already buy goggles. And they're about £400. You can buy a pair of goggles with a display built into the arm, which projects onto the lens, which reflects it into your eye. And you see a display about this big superimposed in the field of view. For a little bit more money, you can get something which is much bigger. But I'm a futurist, not a historian. Those things are already existing. And we worked out that within 5 years from now, it's possible to build a prototype active contact lens. And in about 12 or 13 years on the street, say by 2015, you'll be able to buy these things. You can put two contact lenses into your eyes and see an augmented reality overlay on everything you see in the real world. You've seen Terminator and Robocop, you know, they look at something and they get superimposed information and it says, you know, blah, 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 you know, size, whatever, and, you know, yes, that will fit. All of this sort of stuff. And you can get all of that stuff superimposed in the real world. And of course, the key thing is when you picked up somebody in the nightclub with a 95% personality match, knowing your luck, they'd probably look like me. So you'd normally need a brown paper bag to make them look reasonable. But in the future, you can do a digital overlay, make them look like Brad Pitt or Claudia Schiffer or whatever it is that you want. So that, you know, this virtual reality overlay is with you all the time, and you can do really quite nice things with it. And of course, that means you can meet people in new ways. You're going to have some computer-generated programs, you know, artificial intelligence entities on the computer, which are very, very smart indeed. I'll tell you more about those. And they'll be some of your friends. Whether you like it or not, some of your friends in 15 years will be computer programs. That's horrible to admit, but it's probably the case anyway. And some of your friends will be people that live locally, and some of your friends will be ones that you've met across the net who you've never actually met physically, but you get on with them quite well, even though they live thousands of miles away. But computers are going to catch up very, very quickly. And synthetic personalities are being developed by an awful lot of different labs. And some of you have probably played with a program called The Sims, where you produce a little virtual soap opera on your computer, and you design the house, and you design the people that live in that house. And they use a combination of artificial intelligence and natural language processing and avatar technology. You know, they can actually have quite a good life between each other. And that's getting more and more sophisticated as we go on. And we think it'll not be very long, not very long at all, before artificial intelligence catches up with an IT engineer, and a few years after that, it'll catch up with Joe Public. What this is really heading towards is a revaluation of human skills, because artificial intelligence already has got to the point where 45% of all calls to call centres in most of the USA are dealt with entirely by machine. And it's not, you know, dial 1 for this, and dial 2 for that, and dial 3 for this. You talk to it in everyday language, and it understands what you've said, and it answers your query. And that 45% of transactions can already be dealt with by automatic voice interaction. And gradually, over the next few years, that percentage will ramp up. And gradually, all the professions will fall into that category as well, because the intelligence that's associated with the professions will gradually come into the machine domain. And that really is quite scary. And already you're probably thinking, this guy's talking nonsense, the machine could never do my job, or the job which I'm hoping to do once I leave the LSE and go out in the big bad world. But you think about it. You think about 5 years ago, I was doing lectures to IBM about the future of computing, you know, from a telecoms angle, and congratulating them on how well Deep Blue was doing. And they said, well, interesting talk, but you're completely wrong about computers overtaking people at chess, because there's no way ever that our programs playing chess will ever beat Kasparov at chess, because they use brute force and ignorance, and Kasparov uses human ingenuity, and that you can never compare the two, and computers will never, ever be able to play grandmaster level at chess. And it was about 6 or 7 months after that talk before they finally thrashed Kasparov in a fair fight. And even Kasparov now accepts that computers play better chess than people. And now you can buy computer programmers which will write inventions. And people are talking about patents not being worth anything within 3 or 4 years, because you can ask a computer program to invent the same thing but use a different technique that doesn't violate the patent and stuff. So, you know, patents become worthless. And writing music, I hate to admit that Microsoft had done something nice in this area, but you can already buy software for an Xbox which will write acid or house or jazz or Mozart or Beethoven, and it'll do it in real time. And even Mozart had to sit and think about it before he composed his symphonies. But these computers can do it as fast as you can listen to it. And that really is quite scary. They can't sing, but then if you listen to the top 20 very often, you ask how much of a challenge that really is. And writing novels, you know, surely writing a Mills and Boone romantic novel, I mean, surely that requires understanding of love and romance and humans, emotions and stuff like that. Well, no, it doesn't. It's over 2 years since the first program was able to write a Mills and Boone novel in 2.5 seconds. And you couldn't tell which ones were written by people and which ones by machine. So, you know, very, very quickly indeed, these things are moving from the human domain into the machine domain, and that isn't going to stop. And we have to accept that today you might be the big side of the total productivity of you plus your computer. The computer is just a very advanced calculator and it helps you write documents, but you have actually got all the intelligence. And you are at least 2,000 times smarter than your PC. But you're not getting any smarter, and your PC is. And the rate at which the PC is getting smarter is about a factor of 2 every year. And that means that in 10 or 11 years' time, the PC catches up. And the PC doesn't stop, and it carries on going all the way until you are the tiny little bit, you know, making this stuff palatable by other human beings, and the computer is doing all the work. And I don't see any reason at all as an engineer why it's going to stop once it gets to human-level intelligence. It's going to carry on all the way right through to millions or billions of times smarter. If that happens, it dramatically changes the nature of the economy. Today we're in the information economy and you get paid for being smart, and you guys that are all very smart in this audience, you get paid more than people that are really dumb. And that seems to be a sort of a natural law at the moment. But you don't get paid for having big muscles. I haven't got as much muscle as Arnold Schwarzenegger, but I can, you know, if Arnold Schwarzenegger was digging a hole and I was digging a hole, he'd be able to dig it faster. But I can go out and buy a JCB and dig that hole far faster than Schwarzenegger can, and it doesn't cost really that much money. And in the future, you can take artificial intelligence with the sort of way we're designing it now, and you can devalue the value of intellectual contribution. And what we see happening is that the human contribution, the human skills, become more valuable, because those are the only things that you can't automate. And the intellectual skills can be automated, and the human skills, the interpersonal skills, can't. And that's very frightening for most of us. Think, well, this guy's probably talking nonsense. What's he got that's actually going to happen down this direction? Well, this is the beginnings of the project that we have in BT. It's called Obi-Wan. The target date's about 2010, might be 2011, 2012. We're talking about a glass of gel, maybe slightly more gel than it fits in that glass, maybe 100 mils or so. And in the 100 mils of gel, you can get 1 trillion neurons with 0.01 micron technology. And we already have 2 million different wavelengths that we can use for communication. And those light signals between these neurons will travel at, you know, 2 × 10⁸ meters per second instead of 2 × 10²² meters per second inside your actual physical head. So the communications is 1 million times faster. The clock rate is about 1 million times faster. The number of neurons is 50 times more. And the space that it occupies is much less, so the signals don't have to go as far. And there's a whole stack of benefits you can add up with doing it this way. And on paper, you end up with a figure of about 50 million for the first prototype, Obi-Wan, compared to the human brain. We could have a computer in 10 years' time, which is 50 million times smarter than people. Now, that is scary. If you're not scared by that, you don't understand the concept. It'll have a very, very distributed sensory system. It won't just have the 5 or 6 human senses that we have. It'll have access to network sensors all over the entire planet. This computer's body effectively extends over the entire surface of the planet because it's connected over a few milliseconds delay to every single sensor anywhere. So that's really quite scary. And we're looking at how we might make it conscious. We've got a big pile of neuroscience books about this far and this high, and I'm currently going through them all. And we're looking at ideas from the top neuroscientists of today as to how they think consciousness works. And we're working at how we can emulate these ideas inside the computer to do synthetic consciousness. And so far, we haven't found a single thing which we can't emulate in the computer world. Now, I don't know how consciousness works, but I don't need to. All I need to do is to be able to program a computer with an evolutionary environment, which is equivalent to nature, and give it some basic ideas. And it can mess around with those ideas and use evolutionary techniques until it gets up to human equivalence, and then I can give it access to all of the knowledge across the World Wide Web. It can catch up with humans in no time flat, and then it will design its own offspring and improve the evolutionary environments and do everything else. And you end up with a graph which looks something like that. It goes along exponentially for a while until about 2013, 2014, and then it suddenly goes vertical because the computer can design its next generation, and they can design the next generation after that, better and better and better, and faster and faster and faster. So we reach the fundamental limits imposed by physics in no time at all. It's kind of like E.T. landing and giving us all of the toys out of the spaceship. So much for intelligence. What about the future of genetics and biotechnology and stuff? And already biotechnologists are talking about allowing you to do fetal sex selection and stuff, which, you know, doesn't seem that big a deal. And some people are talking about cloning, and some people say that's good, some people say it's bad. But what about doing DNA optimization? What about taking your DNA and saying, well, you're prone to all of these different diseases. Let's make sure your kids don't have access to those diseases. Let's make sure your kids have got a perfect genome. And furthermore, let's get rid of all of this wasted stuff and put some other stuff in which makes them even smarter and even better looking and more physically fit than you'll ever be, and take away all of the things you don't like. But we're not limited to DNA, because proteomics would go all the way to allow us to create new bases. You know, DNA only allows you to make certain sorts of proteins, and you might want to make different sorts of proteins, but the computers will allow you to simulate those very, very fast, so we can create whole new structures which don't even exist in nature. And we're talking about being able to design smart bacteria, where we can actually assemble electronic components within a cell using biological engines, you know, the different bits of the cell, ribosomes and stuff, which actually assemble the different components, different proteins. You can do the design of those systems in such a way that you can create almost any new organism with any functionality. But it seems to me this has been explored in science fiction, a film called Demon Seed some time ago, where a computer raped a woman and, you know, out popped some hybrid machine very, very soon afterwards, which reached adulthood for some reason in about 20 minutes. I've never quite understood that. But it seems to me that DNA optimization, really, woman plus machine is a problem. And we really should resist any areas where we're starting to optimize DNA, because it's got a very, very bleak future indeed. The future is nothing less than human extinction. If you look through the obvious extrapolation of these technologies, you see that we've gone through a couple of million years of evolution to get us where we are today. And in the next 100 years, maybe even the next 50 or 60 years, we will have access to technology to give us Homo Optimus and Homo Cyberneticus, where we're linked directly into the computer world, and we can do Homo Hybridus, where you've got that link into the computer world and you're biologically optimized, and basically you're a perfect specimen of humanity, but you've got an IQ in four digits. Another word for that is competitor. You can't compete with somebody with all of those assets. And that isn't the end, because ultimately you can converge exactly with entirely with the machine world, and we call it Homo Machinus, where you make a backup of your brain, and when you die, it's not a major career problem because you've got a backup. You just hop down to B&Q and buy an Android and upload your mind into it. And this sounds like very science fiction, but it's actually probably realistic in about 2035, 2040. And that's not that far away. I would dare to suggest that anyone less than 30 in this lecture theatre, which is probably most of you, you probably won't die. Your body will die, but it'll be kind of as inconvenient as losing a fingernail or getting, you know, a small transplant or something. But your mind will continue after your body dies, and you'll be able to carry on as if nothing happened. And you're going to have to work out problems as to how your company handles your pension and stuff once that happens. Are you dead or are you not dead? You carry on here, but do you actually still get a pension? There's all sorts of new problems, which are major economic problems, which result from doing this sort of stuff. But let's go to some real horror stories now for the last few minutes of this. I love looking at the dark side. I did work in the missile industry for 4 years before I joined BT. And, you know, that devious part of my mind still exists. And I still look at every new technology and think, well, how would some terrorist go about using this? Or how could we use this to design a weapon system based on it? And it seems to me that the next weapon of mass destruction that we can think of is smart bacteria. And it's possible to take biotech and nanotech and artificial intelligence and design something which is, maybe a conventional bacterium, maybe micron across, some bacteria bigger than that, some are smaller. And you could design it so that the DNA within that bacterium, which is totally self-reproducible, it can recreate biological circuits within that cell and go down that route and stuff. And you can end up with bacteria which link together into very, very complex devices. And of course, the bigger the bacterial colony gets, the more intelligence is. And you could have bacterial colonies which span over, tens of kilometers and stuff, which are linked together optically, which form superhuman machines. And it's kind of funny watching H.G. Wells' War of the Worlds. And, the concept on there was these guys in the spaceships came along and we were fighting against them, okay, but it was the bacteria that eventually killed them. And I wonder, whether the future of humanity, we all talk about extinction and nuclear war and stuff like that. I don't think that's very likely. I think the most likely forms of human extinction are caused by things we can't see, the nanotech weapons or the biological weapons or the smart bacterial weapons, because you can do it, and that seems to me to be the future. And this brings us to a very big warning. I think that technology is wonderful. I love technology. I can't wait for technology to develop fast enough. But the technology is already racing well ahead of science. And I read the Times this morning and it says government's reducing funding on science research. And if you don't understand the world around you, you're a sitting duck, because the technologists can carry on developing all these new technologies without any new science being done. But unless you really fundamentally understand the world around you, you don't know how to defend against that. And that is a very, very big problem. We've got to make sure we invest much more in fundamental science so we understand the world well enough to defend against these threats that might come from rogue regimes using high technology. If we don't do that, we have an increasing danger. Now, Bill Joy said some time ago we've got about 30 or 40% chance of human extinction this century. Our astronomer royal, Martin Rees, suggested it's about 50%. I would say they're both being very optimistic. They haven't looked at all of the technology that's available for doing mass extinctions and stuff. And if you look at the number of things that could cause oblivion, basically, over the next 50, 60, 70 years, the number is increasing exponentially. I've got a spreadsheet detailing what all of these different risks are, and it's almost a classic exponential curve. It eventually levels off, simply because I don't know what the technologies are going to be invented in 2050, but otherwise it'll probably carry on going exponentially. So once it gets to 1% chance of all of these things, there's millions of different things that might cause an extinction-level event, technology-enabled. Once that level gets to 1%, you've probably got another 30 or 40 years before the mankind is extinct. And we think that 1% level happens around about 2050. So that means that we've got a better than 50% chance of extinction this century. I would say the 50 percentile occurs about 2070. And by the end of this century, unless we make some fundamental changes in the way we do science, we've probably got 80 or 90% chance of extinction. That's that's not just doom and gloom. We think that's a realistic figure. That's based on what we already know about the future. I'm going to finish, though, with some social trends, which are quite different than the rest of the stuff I've looked at. I've only started looking at sociology, so forgive me if I talk absolute nonsense, but I think this is of interest. It seems to me that looking at Maslow's basic hierarchy of needs, this pyramid is quite simplistic and it's been discredited, and the new one's much more complex. But I like to go back to this original form of Maslow's hierarchy for a lot of reasons. And it seems to me that most of the people in this country, in fact, most people in the developed world, are living at the self-actualization level now. We've got all of our basic material needs sorted and stuff. We're not worried about getting eaten by saber-toothed tigers anymore. We've got enough food on the plate. By and large, you've got the first few layers sorted. And most of us have got reasonably good friends and relatives and stuff. So, we've got most of the bottom layers sorted. So we're all doing self-actualization. But there's a big problem in there, because we're all self-actualizing in different ways. No one knows whether they're self-actualizing in the best way possible. And we're starting to see a new form of keeping up with the Joneses. You might do a little bit of Tai Chi in the morning, and you're worried because your next-door neighbor is really into feng shui, and they're into crystals, and they're into this. And everybody's doing different things. And everybody's worried that the next-door neighbors are doing it better than they're doing it. And self-actualization, and the supposed layer above that, and spiritual layer and stuff, people are really going in different ways. And so we're starting to feel a new form of security. Yes, we've got lots of wealth, but we're not sure we're living life to the max. So we're worried about that, and that makes us feel a bit insecure. So even though we're well satisfied in terms of wealth and stuff, we actually still feel insecure. So we're undermining the security layer at the same time as we're seeing increasing crime and increasing global terrorism and lots of other things attacking that layer as well. So Maslow's pyramid is being attacked basically from all sides at the security layer. And what this means is that people today are wealthier than people 10 years ago, but people are taking far more happy pills than they were 10 years ago. And if you extrapolate this into the future, actually the trends get worse and worse and worse. And you can predict that society will be worse in 10 years' time than it is today. People will be much more paranoid about the way they're living their lives. More people will be taking happy pills than are today. If you look at the different behaviours that people use at the when they're faced with growing uncertainty caused by all of the different things happening in the world, some people thrive on it. We get entrepreneurs who love change because they can get an advantage over everybody else. But for every one of those, there are, you know, 10 people who just retreat back into the bubble and put their heads back in the sand and stuff. They live for today. Maybe they go for some inner peace or something. They just try to escape from the problems one way or another. And that's a much more dominant factor in society than the grabbing hold of this change and really using it. So let's look at a few of these in turn. Living for today, anti-science, suspicion of new technology. That's really growing very, very fast in the West. We're seeing a lot of people very anti-science at the moment. Some of you might think, well, that's obvious, you know, that's a good thing to be. We're seeing some people doing downshifting, going back to basics. We're seeing a lot of people going for inner worth in the face of external pressures. And we're seeing increased tribalism and a lot of anti-globalization, which is also linked with anti-capitalism and stuff. I'll explain that later. But it seems to me that one of the really big trends happening in here is something I call 21st century piety. And an awful lot of the stuff happening around, which you've observed yourself, there's an awful lot of people really into environmentalism or anti-capitalism and New Age spirituality variants and stuff. We're seeing a lot of political correctness out there, a lot of people pacifism and stuff. And it seems that as we've thrown away the ancient religions, and Europe, generally speaking, has become much more atheist, what we've done is filled that vacuum with an awful lot of other stuff. And people are now pulling in different directions with different sorts of traits. And we're seeing more increased religious extremism and, you know, extreme vegetarianism, and a lot of people getting quite violent to protect some of these movements. Now, there's absolutely nothing wrong with the moderate side of any of these traits. I'm not criticizing these traits per se. At the extremes, they're all dangerous. Downshifting is actually pretty good. We looked at all of the different traits that people adopt in dealing with uncertainty. We only found two which are positive. One was sort of mainstream religions, which we don't hold any optimism for them recovering in the next 10 years. But a growing trend is downshifting, and people are giving up on the rat race and saying, well, you know, there's no correlation between wealth and happiness, so I might as well just take less wealth and have less stress and get back into my local community and have more family relationships. And that has a very strong correlation with happiness. So they sacrifice 50% of their income, and they're much happier. And a lot of people are starting to do that. And it's one of the few traits which actually works in terms of dealing with this changing world. Increased tribalism, though, is something which pulls society apart, as you'd expect. And we're seeing a lot of decline of trust and social capital and stuff as communities pull apart from a whole stack of different pressures that just didn't exist a few years ago. And you know, that has got to be a problem. But anti-science is the one that really worries me. I'm a scientist, I'm an engineer, I love science and technology, I want to have more of this stuff, but we're seeing increasing rejection of the scientific world. A lot of people just don't trust scientists anymore. In fact, they actually trust us less than politicians in many respects. And you think this is a terrible trend. You know, scientists like to be honest, they like to be open and honest about their research, and they tell people the good and the bad side, but people don't believe them anymore because they don't believe that that's actually the case. And as a result of that trend, whether it's based on reality or not, we expect an anti-technology backlash around about 2010, where people say, that's enough technology, we don't like it, and we're going to see a second Luddite revolution with people smashing up the IT systems and stuff. And in parallel with that, we're seeing a growth of pseudoscience things. You know, every time somebody comes on television now, they're talking about vibrations and energy and chakra and all of this other, you know, complete crap, in my view. But they talk about it all the same, and it's total pseudoscience, and it doesn't have any reality. But it's growing as a popular movement. And these things are linking together in an anti-technology backlash. And we thought about it, we came up with this. I don't know if you can read the text on there, but the rejection of technology really arises from the increased concentration on the market. And then we get less government-funded pure science, exactly what's happened today in the Times. Science is increasingly funded by corporations, therefore there's got to be a profit motive, therefore people get suspicious about it, therefore they get suspicious of the technology resulting from that science, and you end up with a rejection of it. And in exactly the same way, you get the scale of global markets forces people to do things in a different way, which actually results in an activism against all of that. And these trends are very, very strong, and they're actually interlinked. And the capitalism and globalization riots that we're seeing, they're actually quite logical responses to what's happened because of the lack of information that people have really got access to. but this would all be of complete irrelevance. You know, people being upset isn't a problem, except that the technology, paradoxically, gives them a new way of making their upsetness being known. They can be upset in a much more proactive way than they ever could in the past. In the past, you used to just vote somebody out of power and get some new lot in, but, you know, in this country, there's not that much difference between a lot of the attitudes of Labour or Conservative or Liberal Democrat. But we're going to start seeing grassroots power in the next few years, and people can link together on the net, and they can start organising their power at grassroots level. Imagine getting this email in 5 or 10 years' time, and you're interested in environmentalism, and therefore you have personal filters, and your artificial intelligence lets this through. Well, you could get an email like this going off to billions of people. We expect 3 billion people online by 2010. So this could reach almost everybody that's got any money in the world. And all they've got to do is click this little green button, and their electronic commerce preferences automatically exclude anybody from the US in terms of their commerce. So immediately, the USA could be facing economic sanctions like they've never seen before. This does not require 6 months of negotiation in the UN. It's grassroots power. It just means that you get Jonathan Porritt sending an email off to every single environmentalist on the planet, and immediately you can link all of those people together. If the governments choose to ignore that pressure, you can become much more aggressive, and you can start linking together all their IT systems and start planting e-bombs and viruses and all sorts of different ways of bringing down the network. And you can basically take any network you like offline. Now, BT employ a very, very large security group to try and protect us against this sort of stuff, but there's only 30 or 40 of those, and there's 3 billion people trying to kill us. You know, it's a foregone conclusion in due course that the network will increasingly go offline, and as that happens, we see enormous economic devastation. So we've got some very good things happening in the future, we've got some very bad things happening in the future. On balance, I don't actually think it's that much different than today. I think we've always seen new problems, we've always seen some new benefits. I think that tomorrow will not be a techno-utopia, nor will it be a techno-hell. I personally have an interest in the downside, but I don't want you to go away with a doom-mongered impression that the world in the future is nasty, because there's a lot of benefits coming as well. But you know, I hope I've given you something to think about. It's not, you know, quite as simple as the hype that you see sometimes in the papers. Thank you.
I'm going to put up your hand, those of you who'd like to chew smart chewing gum. You see? Ah, yeah, good. You see, only one of you, the rest of you are all frightened like me. I'd just like to introduce Professor Robin Mansell, who's going to thank Ian and say a few words to get our discussion going. Robin, please.
Thank you. Thank you, Ian. It does rather seem to me to achieve the benefits or to experience some of the benefits you were talking about. We do have to stay alive. I think that's a very important thing to think about at the end of the day. When I was reflecting on Homo cyberneticus, I think he said, security, risk, and these social issues, I thought the big message needed to be, we don't just need to invest in science, we need to invest in social science. And I would say that because I'm here at the LSE. A lot of the issues, I think, are the ones which social scientists grapple with all the time that you're raising. And whether things look good and whether things look bad depends a lot on your starting point from a social point of view. And I was thinking, there's a fellow named Herman Kahn, who I think founded the Hudson's Institute, and did a lot of futures work. And they published a book in 1976, which was called The Next 200 Years. And one of the things that he and others said was that contemporary issues, and I'm quoting, are often not fully understood until they have become history. Futures work, however, can furnish a context by giving us an artificial vantage point from which to look backward. In 1976, that was the year of the US bicentennial, I think, a lot of people were thinking that the prospects for human beings were quite dim. And instead, these people came along and said, we don't have much time for that conclusion, that prospects are dim and that the chances are rising exponentially, that we'll all be not on the planet any longer. And instead they said we needed to look into the longer time frame, into the future, and have both public and private institutions being used essentially as early warning systems. And I think for BT, that's one of the things that you've been doing, is creating early warning systems. But Kahn saw science and technology and innovation as a basis for optimism. not pessimism. And they said the dangers existed, and just as you said a minute or two ago, I said they always have existed, and they always will. We can't eliminate danger. So I guess the question is, as they put it in that book, if we want to face the future boldly, and we want to do so openly, do we not have to conclude that it's not just that we can do these things with technology, but that perhaps sometimes we shouldn't? And so my question to you, I guess, is who are the actors in this? Who, besides scientists, are going to be able to set the parameters and reach the conclusions about what they value and which technologies we might actually take forward and put into the commercial market? Once again, thanks.
This works. Yeah, thanks, Robin. I am an optimist usually. I like to look at the downside of things because it's fun. But I am inherently an optimist. I really believe we need, you know, future technology. There's a lot of the problems facing us as a species, such as environmental problems and stuff, which you can only deal with by much more advanced technology. You can't solve the problems of the world today with today's technology. We have to develop technology. I don't think there's any question of that at all. I would never want to hold back the technology. What I'm arguing for is that because some of these technologies that we're dealing with are so powerful, and because some of the consequences are potentially so dangerous, we need to be a lot more careful in the ways in which we do that. We have to develop them, there's no question, but how we develop them is really up for grabs. And we have to develop them in a much more careful way than we are currently doing. There's no good in doing genetic modification experiments and just throwing everything out in nature and seeing whether it kills us all or whether it works okay. That's not a very valid way of doing it. There's no point in developing nanotech stuff and saying, well, you know, let's chuck a few nanotech devices out there, and well, you know, probably it won't kill us all, but we'll just hope. I don't want to go into the future with my fingers crossed. I'd rather go into the future with some good scientific basis for what we're doing, knowing that when we do this, this is exactly what will result. That requires a great deal more raw science to be done, and social science. I've no disagreement with that. We need a lot more basic science in our society than we're currently doing, and maybe a little bit less emphasis on the profit motive. And if that slows down the profit generation, well, I'm quite happy. I want to go to a techno-utopia, but I want my child to be still alive whenever that happens. I don't want to get to a techno-utopia 10 years earlier if that's going to cause, you know, extinction of mankind. So all I'm asking is that we should be a little bit more careful as we go into the future. And as individuals, we have that capability. As I suggested in the last few slides, linking people together on the net gives us grassroots power to resist things that people don't like. And I don't need to do that myself, because lots of people out there are much more activist than I'll ever be, and they're better at coordinating things like that. I mean, we see groups like Greenpeace and Friends of the Earth doing it, and I disagree with them on an awful lot of the things that they do, but their basic principles are quite sound. Now, I'm not going to suggest you should all go out and join Greenpeace and Friends of the Earth, because sometimes they get it wrong and they actually make things worse. I don't know what the best way is to go, but we shouldn't just carry on going down the path regardless of what might result. We need to be much more adventurous in our thinking about how this could be misused, and to try and protect against those downsides so that we get the benefits without the downside.
Right, thank you. Now, we do have some time for a few questions from the floor. I'm sure there are going to be lots. But one here at the front first.
Hi, York.
Yeah. You have to.
I would like to ask you how you think one can be more careful in terms of controlling technology. In other words, you're working for British Telecom. There are other people at IBM and all over the world who are doing research and looking at where we could be going. But is there any comparable group which is saying we have to really to be more careful and see how we can control the development of technology? Is there any lobby, as it were, which is working for the control of technological development and preventing our human extinction?
Yeah, I mean, today we certainly have regulatory bodies, I mean, such as Ofcom and stuff, regulate our industry, that, you know, they regulate what we're allowed to do and so on. And there are other regulatory bodies for the biotech industries and the materials industry and stuff. But I don't think they're very well clued up necessarily on the convergence side of these things. You know, the Ofcom don't look at things like smart bacteria. They're interested in how much you should be allowed to charge for a text message on a mobile phone network or things like that, and how much should we be allowed to charge for broadband. They're looking at very, very short-term issues. And what we need to do is to get them to think about the much longer term issues. And I've talked to some of these people, and they're all very clever, and you know they've got their work cut out just dealing with the short term. But that's not an excuse. We need more of them if necessary, and we should spend more of it to protect this, because you know we need to do this safely. You know, we have to get the technology. I want the technology, but we've got to do it in a way which doesn't kill my daughter and you know kill all of our offspring. If it takes a few years longer to develop it, well, so be it.
Gentleman at the back, sitting right at the back.
Yes, maybe I've got carried away too much by your talk, which was fascinating, but it seems to me, when you talk about computerization by the middle of this century, that there's a distinct prospect that people will no longer be in charge, that the computers will make the decision and people will not be able to do much about it.
Yeah, that's the classic Terminator scenario, really, where the computers make the decisions and you know, eventually they don't like us and they get rid of us. I don't think it'll go that way. What I think will happen is that the advanced technologies will be harnessed in such a way that we can link to those. I think when push comes to shove and somebody decides whether to switch on a machine which is going to be smarter than they are, they might think about that and think, well, that's actually not a very good idea until we've got some way of harnessing it and making sure that it's a safe thing to do. So this idea of getting, you know, the homo machinist link, where we can link our brains directly to the machine world, if you can harness that advanced intelligence as a human attribute, then that stops us from being wiped out by an advanced machine race. You're not going to get a Terminator scenario if we're as smart as the machines. That only happens if you've got a machine race and a human race and the machines are much smarter. It isn't going to happen if we're the same. So if we get the technology where we can link to the nervous system and eventually link directly into the brain and link our thoughts into very, very fast matrices and stuff, then it's a safe way to do it. And I think that's entirely possible to go down that path. It is entirely feasible to do this safely. You can link computer chips to the nervous system. That's already been done in prototype. What we do need is a nanotechnology device to allow you to link to every single neuron in your brain and to basically enhance the performance of those neurons by X factor, and then you keep up with the machines. And the machines don't get ahead, and we stay fundamentally human, and we're still in control. That is a safe way of proceeding into the future, where we get all the benefits, and we don't get the extinction caused by being wiped out by Terminator or something. But other than that, you know, the only thing on Terminator which isn't feasible is that the people win.
Right, thank you. Now we have lots of questions here. I'm going to take two or three questions together, actually. Yeah. So this gentleman here first, and then this way, and then that way, right? Just take all. We'll take three questions first. Yeah,
that's all right.
Yeah. Right. We'll keep you.
I would greatly appreciate some practical guidance to older children, whether to study physics rather than chemistry, biology. To go, what prospects are there for lawyers and accountants in future?
Sure.
I mean, there are students here, and I think some of them would appreciate some guidance from you.
Just here in front. We'll take three questions again.
I have a more specific question. Like, can you throw more light on like how can like a beaker full of artificial neurons can acquire the ability to like basically undergo Pavlovian conditioning so they can evolve into like better beings? Like what's engineering wise or biomedically,
sure.
How are you
yep.
planning to do
okay,
that?
Okay, we'll just take a third one here on the left and we're going upstairs on the next round, right?
Hi, just a quick question about what I would see as sort of an innovation paradox. What I see coming out of your debate and your discussion is that machines are going to evolve and get smarter and smarter. But the thing I don't think anyone's addressed is that people build machines and design machines, and people have flaws. Therefore, I would expect that machines will have flaws, and as they evolve, they will also those flaws will expand, et cetera, and if they begin designing machines, then those flaws will carry on.
Yep.
So I'm just wondering what your take is on that. It's the best example I can think of is I know a famous author who wrote a nice book about technology, and he went onto Amazon.com and they said, we've got just the best book for you. It's your book. So they recommended buy his own book. So I think that sort of shows, like with bots and things, how things don't necessarily always evolve perfectly.
Let me try and remember all of those. I mean, the first one was about what should you basically study at university these days and what should you pursue as a career. I really believe in this idea of the care economy, where we move very, very quickly away from an information economy based on intellectual skills to one which the machines basically provide most of that intellect, and we will be in supervisory role offering the human skills. So jobs which are dependent on interpersonal skills, caring and stuff, that's why we call it the caring economy. There's an awful lot of jobs, but 20% of today's economy requires you to have some fundamental human interaction with other people. And those jobs will expand as a percentage of the economy. In just the same way as maybe 100 years ago, only 20% of people worked in the service economy, and everyone wondered how that could ever work, because everyone was still working in agriculture and manufacturing, which is now less than 20% of the population. So in much the same way, we're going to see compression of the service economy, and those things which require fundamental human skills will persist, and they will expand. And those things which are basically just, you know, data entry and number processing and applying intellect and stuff, they will disappear. So it's a hard thing to say to people just coming out of university today, but intellect will not be of any value in, say, 20 years' time. What is of value is nice personality and nice, warm, cuddly human skills, which is more or less independent of your IQ. You might call it, you know, EQ or something. I don't particularly like that sort of model, but I think that's much the way it's going. The second question, if I remember it rightly, was about how on earth you design something, you know, gel of fluid, which is going to become smart. Well, you know, basically, we've already demonstrated the capability of using evolution as an electronic design technique. We had the idea way back in the 1980s that you should be able to take a field programmable gate array, which is a, you know, very complex chip where the paths on that chip aren't predetermined, and you just structure them according to how you want it once it reaches the, you know, the field. So you field program it. And we thought, well, if you can do that, and if you can reconfigure it, you could keep on mutating this time and time again until it comes up with something which is a really neat way of doing it. And so we asked this computer to try and come up with a design of something which could recognize the tones on a telephone keypad, and distinguishing which tone it was that you generated when you pushed, you know, 1, 2, 3, or 4 or whatever, requires 16 electronic components. And that was the best possible circuit that could ever be designed by a human being. No one could design this with less than 16 components. So the computer went away for a whole weekend and sat and thought about it, mutated the circuit and did all sorts of things. And it came back Monday morning, they looked at the results and it used 12 components. And I thought, hang about, you know, this is a really spectacular improvement. We've got 25% improvement on efficiency. How does it work? And it took them 2 or 3 weeks before they figured out that it worked in a totally different way than any human design circuit. It was using the analog domain. It wasn't a digital processor at all anymore. The four components which weren't connected actually worked. It was using their inductance and capacitance rather than their digital field, really. So it was a very, very different way. And we've been playing with the idea of evolution ever since. And you can in that way, where you basically show the computer what a blue-green algae looks like, and then you let it go away and use brute force and ignorance and, you know, millions of synthetic years of evolution to come up with something which is a veritable rainforest full of very, very complex relationships and very, very complex algorithms. And you can keep on going and going and going. So we don't know how consciousness works. We don't need to know how consciousness works. We can give the computer a few ideas based on current neuroscience, and it can go away and play with those and just mutate them until it comes up with something which works. And certainly in raw number crunching terms, we've got enough neurons there to achieve consciousness many, many times over. It could simulate tens of millions of people simultaneously in principle. So we think the evolutionary approach is enough to get us down that path.
The flaws.
Because this is based on evolution, and every single generation of it is tested according to the evolutionary environment and the criteria imposed by that, it doesn't need to have any flaws. The computer programs which you generally evolve don't have bugs in them, because the bugs tend to be evolved out and things tend to be bug-proof. I can't remember the last time I walked through a forest and saw, you know, instead of a tree being there was a 404 not found message. It just doesn't happen in nature. Nature has come up with a completely foolproof way of solving algorithms. And an insect colony, if you step on 10 ants out of an ant colony, nobody notices. You know, the ant colony works on a slightly reduced efficiency, but it carries on, and eventually it breeds some more ants and makes up the deficit. So nature is very, very robust in the sorts of solutions it comes up with. And, you know, basically we lose control of those algorithms long, long time before you get to machine consciousness. I wouldn't think that people would be working in the design of computers even by 2010. Almost all of the design of computers is already done by machine. People just do the very final tweaking at the moment. And in a few years' time, they won't even bother doing that. So the computers will be designed by their parents rather than by human beings. So human frailties don't really enter the equation.
Right. Just take some questions, three questions from upstairs. So this, here. Yeah.
Can you hear me? From?
Yeah.
Oh, thanks. Hi. I can predict the future as well, and I see a lot of civil liberties issues arising from this, and I was wondering if you can address that, especially privacy.
Yeah, I'm very worried by privacy issues. It's already we've got the most surveillance of any country in the entire world, even today, and yet every day we see more speed cameras, we see all sorts of things. The government is doing a trial at the moment about putting chips into your engine in your car so that you cannot physically speed when you get to a 30 zone, because it will automatically slow your car down at the 30 zone. And some people say this is wonderful, this will improve it, it'll stop accidents. And when you actually look at it properly, you actually see it will actually increase accidents because of a whole stack of complex relationships. And it isn't very simple, but the government can track what you do. They already know where you are. We can already pinpoint exactly where you are based on your cell phone. We also know the chap sitting right beside you because of his cell phone. And if your partner doesn't like the fact that you're sitting beside him, we could, in principle, send them a blackmail notice asking you for some money. And that could be a future business. Now we're not a nasty company. We're not going to do that. But somebody out there could do that. If you can hack into the systems and get access to those files about the positioning of individuals and use the traffic cameras and stuff and the French rebuild, because when they do a speed camera offense, they photograph you and to prove that you're in the car, and they also photograph the person in the passenger seat who might not necessarily be your wife, who might object to that secretary being there or something. And we see a lot of civil liberties issues coming up. We've already seen demonstrations outside stores because of radio frequency identity tags. I think it was Gillette or Wilkinson Sword that put identity tags into their razors because they lose 40% of the razors after they leave the factory before they reach the till. They get stolen. And they wanted to find out where they got stolen. So they put the little tags in to find out who it was that was nicking all their razors. And immediately we saw fundamental Christian groups outside saying, this is 666, mark of the beast, we can't have this sort of stuff. You know, there are a lot of civil liberties issues in all of this. And some of it is based on nonsense, some of it is based on reality. I'm quite paranoid already, but you know, this it's going to get a lot worse.
There's a question here at the front, yeah. And then the line.
In this scheme of things?
There's a big lag between the developing countries and the rest of the world. In the short term, the difference in terms of wealth between what we can do here with our wealth and what they can do there with lack of wealth, the gulf increases in the short term. But something very interesting happens. If you're in China and you're thinking, well, you know, we haven't got a telephone network, what are we going to do? You don't start putting in a copper network. You start putting in a third generation mobile network using satellites and everything else, and you use state-of-the-art technology. So what you end up with a fraction of the investment is something vastly superior to what the West has got in place, you know, where we're trying to milk, you know, our networks from what they're worth for postpone replacement and stuff in order to save money. But some of these third world countries are actually leapfrogging over us in terms of technology. And that's going to happen increasingly quickly over the next couple of decades. And as the technology gets cheaper and cheaper and cheaper, you know, quite literally, in 10 years' time, you'll be able to get access to a device for less than $100, which will give you full-time access to the internet, all the world's best educational resources, they're all online, and it'll give you free telecoms. And you can sell your wares on the global superhighway. You know, a lot of people out there can afford that $100 investment for somebody in their village to do that. And then the money starts pouring in because they can compete against the Microsoft programmers in the UK and in the USA and stuff. So they can start getting rich very, very quickly. I think IT will be a great leveler, and we're going to see the third world catching up very, very quickly indeed. Because you know, even in the short term, the 20-year term, we're going to see that gap closing immensely. I think
it's quite exciting. One final question there. Yeah, there are lots of questions. I'm sorry, but we could go all night. But
hi there. Sorry, I think before you mentioned that in order to move towards safe technological advancement, we were going to have to concentrate more on scientific research. Mm. And perhaps less on profit margins. But do you think this is really possible in this day and age when so much emphasis is put on multinationals and when a government has less charge over multinationals if companies can simply move elsewhere if they aren't happy with the policies that the government is enforcing?
Instinctive answer would be no, it's not possible. But then you look at what's actually been achieved by these grassroots movements. You know, for want of profit, companies went into genetic engineering and started producing things which would last longer in a supermarket shelf and be more resistant to pesticides or whatever it might be. And they did that without consultation with the public. And the public reaction was, you know, a few guys going out in white suits with some TV cameras and causing mayhem, you know, chopping down a few fields. And before you know it, the entire public is refusing to buy GM foods from Tesco's and Sainsbury's, and that entire industry takes an about turn. Grassroots power is immensely powerful. And if we start getting too many invasions of civil liberties, or we start seeing too much technology being developed, which is, you know, replacing people's jobs with artificially intelligent machines or whatever it might be, if public outcry is sufficient against that, those companies have no choice but to backtrack and find some other more humane way of doing things. You know, public power is very, very powerful. You don't need governments, you just need grassroots power. And the internet allows you to mobilize that much more effectively than you can today. So, you know, the jury's not out on these things. There's no guarantee you're going to get any of these technologies unless people want them. You know, we don't want to develop technologies that you don't want to buy. There's no interest in us doing that at all. Sometimes you misunderstand what the public wants, and you try to develop something because you think they might want it, but the public are very, very quick usually to tell you if they don't like that. So, you know, you can react against it.
All right, well, we're going to stop there. I just want to, before I thank Ian, just to say that the cocktails are upstairs on the fifth floor, okay, and the lift is not an advanced form of technology, so some of you may have to take the stairs. Could I just thank Ian for what's been a wonderful evening? I'm not at all sure about that chewing gum being part of the telephone network. I find that deeply alarming. But can I thank him for what's been a marvellous lecture? Ian, thank you.